This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you. They're not going to call themselves that, but we can. Men and women who have put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget. And along the way, not only are we educated and entertained, we're quite frequently inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And we're going to hear from a pretty good storyteller today, Alan Rasmussen of Fresno, California, a 92-year-old decorated combat medic from World War II. And you're going to hear me talk a little less today because sometimes he answers my questions before I even ask him. We'll hear some of his battlefield memories with the 71st Infantry Division, a couple encounters with General George S. Patton, and what Alan saw when his unit helped liberate a concentration camp in Gunskirchen, Austria. Like so many of the veterans you've heard from on this show, he wouldn't have met his wife if things hadn't gone just the way they did during World War II. And I know there are 3 kids, 6 grandkids, and 11 great-grandkids who are pretty thankful for that. Born in Applegate, California, near Auburn, he ended up going to schools all over Merced County as his family dealt with the Great Depression. He graduated from Merced High School in 1939, took the $269 he had saved up after 4 years of working after school, and he went to the University of California at Santa Barbara with the goal of becoming an industrial arts teacher. Santa Barbara is where he was on December 7th, 1941.
So we heard people talking out in the streets. We opened the window and looked out there. What's going on? She said, haven't you heard? No. She said, Japs bombed Pearl Harbor. Wow. That was Sunday. When Monday went to school, things were in uproar. Most of the fellows going to college there were on reserve, and Army, Navy, whatever, and so they started to leave right away. Well, I'd always wanted to be a pilot, to fly airplanes. So I went down to the local place where the Air Force office was. Oh, yeah, we want you. So they said, show up tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock. We have a bus out here. We'll take you down to L.A. for induction. Great, I'm going to be a flyer. Get down, go through the induction. Went through with flying colors. Got to the eyesight. My eyesight was perfect, 20/20. He gave me this color chart, a little round circle, about 4 or 5 inches in diameter with pastel dots. Guy said, what do you see? I said, I see 69. No, he said, that's 88. Colorblind chart. I think the Japanese did that on purpose to kick me out of the service.
They didn't want any piece of you in the Pacific.
No. So I tried the Navy, same thing. So I went back to school and I hung in there. I wanted to quit, but I only had a little over half a semester done. So I talked to the teachers. Well, no, we can't give you a grade, not yet. So it lasted on into January, and I went up to visit with a friend of mine. He was up at his girlfriend's house. I went up there and walked in. Bill and his girlfriend were sitting there. So Bill said, what are you going to do, Al? I said, I'm going to go down to Los Angeles, see if I can find a place working in the aircraft plant. So the girl said, oh, my dad's home this weekend. And I heard a voice say next door, come on over here. So I went into the den. This gentleman was sitting there. He was probably in his late 40s, early 50s. Sit down. Okay, sat down. He said, I work at Northrop Aircraft. He said, you think you want to go work down there? I said, tell me about it. So he did. He asked me questions. Well, I'd industrial arts teacher in 2.5 years. I'd had sheet metal. I knew riveting. I could read blueprints of any kind. He thought, well, you're pretty well qualified. So he pulled a card out of his pocket, turned over, took a pen out of his pocket, and wrote something on the back of it. Handed it to me. Said, when you go down to Northrop, he said, get the personnel. He said, and whoever comes to the desk, hand it to him. So a week later, said to the gal at the desk, I'm looking for personnel. Right down the hall and on your right. So I headed down the hall, walked up the counter. A young lady stood up. How may I help you? I handed her the card. She held it in her hand and looked at it. And I said, turn it over, because I'd already looked on the back. The guy had written on the back, this is Alan Rasmussen. I know him. Hire him. Well, she read that. She took off in the back room. And out came the head of personnel. I had first-class treatment. He said something to the girl, and we sat in his office there and talked for about 15 minutes. He asked me all about my background, what I knew, et cetera, and so on. So after about 15, 20 minutes, he said, so you want to go to work, huh? I said, yep. He said, when? I said, tomorrow. So I went to work at Northrop graveyard shift. Well, I went to work there, and DL was fun. I had no problem. So about a week or so later, the boss came out to DL. You know a lot about this stuff. Yeah, I told you I was trained to be an industrial arts teacher. He said, we're going to move you up the rank a bit. So I moved to a little more advanced job. And by, October of 1943, I was a lead man running the line building the P-61 Black Widow. That was the first all-electronic fighter plane. Painted black, went out at night, got the Jap planes. So I had told the boss, I was running a crew of about 35 to 40 men and women by that time. Told the boss I want the best-looking girls on my crew.
So you had that kind of pull, huh?
Well, yeah, I was a lead man. So anyway, one morning, here the gal personnel comes down the hall, three young ladies with her. One of them was blonde, looked good. So I nudged one of the guys working, said, "See that blonde over there? I'm going to marry her." "Oh, come on, Al." "No, I'm going to marry her." So sure enough, Norm took one girl over to another part, another one across from another place. Brought this little blonde over to me. He said, "Al," he said, "I got another worker for you here." He said, "Her name is Mildred Machula. She'll be working with you. Take good care of her." I said, "I will, Norm." So the Lord again had me and her in his hand. She came all the way from Canada above Minnesota with a girlfriend by train down to Los Angeles, and she came to work at Northrop. Now, again, the Lord has me in his hand. She was a good little worker. She would learn fast doing riveter. You've all probably heard of Rosie the Riveter in World War II. Well, she was Rosie the Riveter.
Or Millie the Riveter, anyway.
Millie, well, yeah. So anyway, I was trying to get acquainted with her, and I'd visit with her at lunchtime and so forth. I called her Millie. Her girlfriend hated me. She didn't like that Millie name, but I called her Millie. I said to her one day, I said, "How about give me your phone number? I'll give you a call." "Nope." "Where do you live?" "Nope." Really playing hard to get. I thought, what am I going to do? Well, I went up to the counter, pulled out a little card box, pulled her card out, wrote her phone number down and address. If I did that day, I'd get put in jail probably. Anyway, so after work that night, I jumped in my car, went up, found where she lived, went down to the main street there, a little telephone booth out there. I gave her a call. "Hi, Millie," I said, "I just happened to be in the area on business." I didn't tell her it was monkey business. But I said, "I'd like to stop by and see you." "Well, you can stop by, but you can't come in." "Well," I said, "we'll go bowling." "Okay." So I get up there, and she's all dressed up, and we went bowling. Well, and that day, in those days, there were so many people coming in from all over the United States to work in the war industry that we went to bowling. I would have had to wait an hour and a half for an alley. Well, we sat there and talked for a while, and we had to both get up early the next morning to go to work, so we went to a drive-in. Of course, we ordered the standard fare, you know, milkshake, hamburger, french fries. We were eating away, and she said, "Would you hand me a serviette?" I had no idea what a serviette was. So I was going to grab the whole tray and pull it in the car and give it to her. She said, "No, I mean one of those paper things there." She wanted the paper napkin. So I gave it to her. And I said, "What's the deal with that?" "Well," she said, "in Canada, a napkin or a nappy is a baby diaper. We call them serviettes." So anyway, we kept visiting, and she said she liked to dance, and I liked to dance. I decided to ask her if she'd go out and dance with me. She said, "Yes, I will." Had a great time. But when she came to the door, when I went to pick her up, on her left finger, she had a big ring. "Uh-oh," I said. "I never said a word about it." So we went dancing Saturday after Saturday, and we were starting to get along pretty darn good. About the seventh or eighth time we went out, I said to myself, "She has that ring on. No use fighting it." So I told her that. I said, "Millie, if you have that ring on when I pick you up tomorrow night, why, I'm just going to go home and we'll still be friends." We go down and pick her up. She walked out, no ring. Well, she'd come in October. This was after Christmas. I said, "You're not wearing the ring." Well, she said, "My girlfriends wrote me letters and said that my boyfriend, who was in the Royal Canadian Air Force, had come home for a leave on Christmas time, and he was chasing the girls all over town." So I decided, well, enough of him. So we went along, and that was in after Christmas. Well, by about June, I decided I wanted to go into service. Well, Northrop and all the industry, war industry, had a ruling from the government that if a man was working for you in a job that was very necessary, he didn't have to go into service.
Yeah, so you could have enjoyed that exemption for a long time.
Yeah, uh-huh. So anyway, I knew that they'd give me a bad time if I told them. So I was talking to the guy. He said, well, go down to the draft board. Maybe they can help you. So I went downtown. Lady was sitting by her desk in the corner. I walked in, being fairly outspoken. I said, hi, how you doing? I want to go in the service. I work at Northrop. Oh, boy, they're hard to get away from. So we talked for a while. I said, well, I'll write a couple letters, and maybe I can get you in. So a week and a half later, I get a letter in the mail, show up for induction. So I did. Went through, and it was amazing. I walked in the place. There were long lines, maybe 20, 30 fellows in the line. I had my papers in my hand. The guy said, let me see your papers. He looked at me, wrote something on. I said, go to the head of the line. Said, these guys have obviously been here for a long time. He said, well, it's a little different with you. What's that? See that color band across the top of your papers? I said, yep. He said, these guys are all draftees. You're a volunteer. You go to the head of every line here. So I got through there in a very short time. They hauled me down to a Army base south of L.A., shipped me up to Camp Roberts, California. When you go in, when you sign up and go through these, you write down what you're interested in. Well, I put down I was interested in shooting, rifles, et cetera, and so on. So they put me in a company that was training, they call them camp mechanics. We were taught to work with the weapons used in the infantry, to know how to take them apart, repair them, clean them, all that good stuff. I figured we're getting close to being shipped out, so we talked about marriage, and we decided to get married. So I got married a weekend. You couldn't leave camp on your pass until lunchtime on Saturday. Well, I went into the sergeant. Sorry, Al, he said, you know, he said, we can only leave 20% of the men off at any one time. And we had them, they're all got passed already. So who do I see in line next? Well, he said, I guess you can see the battalion commander. I said, may I have permission to see the battalion commander? He said, oh, go ahead. He laughed. But I got a head up there. He told me the same thing. So I said, who's the next man? He said, the regimental commander. I said, may I have permission to see the regimental commander? He started to laugh. He said, you are persistent. He wrote me a pass. Here you go. Go down. So I went. I left camp at 7 o'clock in the morning. First ride out with a woman officer and took me down, I think, Ventura or someplace. From there on down to L.A. and hitchhiked out, and we got married that evening. So then we had another weekend pass. Came back and passed. They had a big bulletin board outside the barracks with papers on it with list of who and where you're going. There was my name, Fort Meade, Maryland, with a date to get there.
And you'd get there after a week's honeymoon with Millie in Santa Barbara, and from Maryland they sent you to Fort Benning, Georgia to join the 71st Infantry Division as a rifleman. But that didn't sit well with you?
Well, I thought I'm going to look around for something else within the division.
Why was that? What didn't you like about a rifleman?
I didn't want to be a rifleman. I thought that there's other things there where I might learn more or something. So anyway, I'm sort of thinking, what the heck am I going to do? Well, I was sitting out there talking to a buddy of mine. He said, Al, he said, they need a medic up in the aid station. Boy, I took off on almost dead run, got up there, walked in, permission to see the head guy, doctor, captain. So I said, I understand you need a medic. He said, yes, we do. So he started to ask me questions. Well, I'd been around the block, you know. I had physiology. I knew the body. I knew where all the pressure points were, where the arteries were, and all that kind of blown in. He said, okay. He said, I'll send a pass, a transfer down to your company for you. So we went to intensive training as a medic.
And it was as a medic that you shipped out from New York in late 1944?
I was a medic. We had Red Cross on our armbands and on our helmet. So we're going up the gangplank on the ship, and I was head of the line. So a guy put his arm down in front of me and said, you and next 11 guys, follow me. Okay, and we're all medics. So he took us out to the ship's medical bay. He said, I'm assigning you to work here for the crews. I thought, gee, work? I don't want to do that. It was the best thing that ever happened.
Why is that?
They had about 20 beds in there. We didn't have to go down and sleep down in that old bag bunk they had for us.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go steal food from the officer's mess. They put the stuff out in the companionway to thaw it out. So we cooked our own meals up there, and we had a good time.
Was it hard to leave and say goodbye to Millie and not know if you were going to see her again?
I can remember that to this day just as perfect as if I was standing there now. We went to LAX to the Army Air Base, was right parallel. And I went up to the fence, and the guard said, how can I help you? I said, I'm flying east. Got something going? So he called, yeah, I got a BT-13. So anyway, grabbed her and gave her a big old kiss, and they opened the gate and my duffel bag, and I left that lipstick on my mouth for as long as it stayed on there. I never washed it off. Oh, I forgot to tell you, when I was at Fort Benning, Georgia, I'd been in the Army about 2 months. I got a letter from her. She said, honey, I'm pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't get to see her for 21 months. Anyway, I'll finish that story.
We'll make sure you do, but it's break time for now. 92-year-old Alan Rasmussen of Fresno, California, our guest today. When we come back, some of his experiences as a combat medic. Also, what he's thankful to General George S. Patton for, and what it was that took Alan off the lines toward the end of World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.